Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, and today I'd like to introduce a wonderful interview with author Debbie Applegate. Debbie has curated our newest online exhibition titled Call Her Madam, Sex, Crime, and Fun in Polly Adler's New York. In just a moment, you'll learn a lot about Polly Adler and who she was through this wonderful interview with our creative director, David Leopold. Before we play the interview, I want to remind you, you can follow along with this online exhibition in the show notes. There's a link directly to our newest online exhibition, Call Her Madam, and you can see the images that Debbie and David are talking about during this interview. So sit back, relax, enjoy the show, and enjoy our interview with Debbie Applegate.
On today's show, we have Debbie Applegate, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer whose new book is Madam, the Biography of Polly Adler, a Jazz Age Icon. And it's a wonderful book. If you've never heard of Polly Adler, you're not alone, but she was the most famous madam of the Jazz Age. And that title even does not do her justice. In those heady days between the world wars, she was one of New York's most celebrated hostesses and an underworld icon. Her swinging parties and deluxe bordellos were patronized by some of the biggest names of the era, luminaries like Frank Sinatra, Duke Ellington, Dorothy Parker, Milton Berle, Al Capone, Huey P. Long, and it was rumored President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Even Al Hirschfeld, that broad-minded boulevardier, admitted to stopping into Polly's brothels on occasion. And Debbie, we want to talk more about Polly. It's a fascinating character that you have really brought to life in the pages of your book. And so tell us a little bit more about who Polly was.
Polly would have called herself a classic American success story with an underworld twist. She was born in 1900, more or less. She was never quite sure exactly when. In Russia, when just before the World War I broke out, she came to the United States. She was only 13 years old in 1913 when she arrived, and her rest of her family was going to follow in installments, as she liked to describe it. But the problem is World War I broke out, leaving her stranded alone in the United States in Springfield, Massachusetts, living with pretty much with strangers, while her family was stuck back in Russia due to the war. This really was the turning point of her life. Here she is, a 13-year-old girl, very little education, no skills, no family to speak of around. And ended up taking a path that was very different from the one that she expected. She goes to Brooklyn, where she has some cousins, and quickly finds that as an unsupervised teenager running around the streets of Brooklyn, she got herself into trouble very quickly. And she gets pregnant by her boss. Her boss refuses to marry her. He rapes her, in fact, she is, to be very specific. She has to have an abortion. She gets kicked out of her house by her cousins, and now she has to decide what's she gonna do. She becomes, let's just say very quickly, within a year or two, by the beginning of Prohibition, she has entered the sex trades. By the end of 1920, she has become a madam. She's moved up quickly from worker to management. And by 1923, as Prohibition is really roaring, she has become the madam, the hostess of choice for the bootleggers and the gamblers who you might know from Damon Runyon's stories, like, Guys and Dolls, exactly, like Guys and Dolls, or that you might know from any of the movies, the gangster movies of the period. And they quickly turn her house into sort of the playground of the speakeasy set. She starts to attract people, what we would now call the cultural influencers. And by 1925, she is making $1 million a year. She has become famous for her girls, for her hospitality, and very quickly has become a major figure in this sort of demimonde of New York City.
And what was it about her house that made it the place to be?
Well, you know, she certainly was not the only madam in New York City. There were many, many. The sex trades were thriving then and probably now. We just don't see it quite the same way. But now that we have the internet, you don't need to have big brothels like this. But she was modern. Her career really was made with prohibition itself. Prohibition turns everything upside down, topsy-turvy. So that before, if you wanted to get a drink, you would have to go to a saloon. Well, women didn't go to saloons. Most respectable people did not go slumming in the underworld. But then after prohibition comes, it becomes a sort of chic almost to break the law. If you want to have a beer, you have to deal with lawbreakers. You are a lawbreaker, in fact. And so there's a real moment during that period where all of a sudden everyone wants to associate with gangsters. They want to associate with women of the night. So she really rides that trend in a way that the other madams of the time who were not quite as ambitious, not quite as hip, not quite as... smart, frankly, as she was, did not. So she turns her house, she has four women at any given time living with her, sometimes more. She creates a deluxe version of what would otherwise be a kind of scummy little place. Best food, she has a cook, around the clock. People would often drop into her house just because the food was so good. If you wanted a late night snack, she has the best liquor at a time when people are going blind from drinking lousy bootleg booze, and she has the prettiest girls. So you start with those things already. She's already got the sense that she's got what she calls the Broadway idea, that you add a little glamour and you can always charge more for it if you make it look glamorous. But then she can't advertise like a normal person, like a normal business. So she hits upon this plan that what she does is she goes to all the speakeasies and the nightclubs with a posse of her best looking girls most weekends. And so she is basically a walking billboard. She and her girls are walking billboards at a time when people are looking for a little more trouble, looking for a little more vice. She describes people actually following her home from the nightclubs. She had a very discreet little card, like a lot of the speakeasies at the time, just a little parrot on it with her phone number, no address. There was something about it that was a kind of underworld chic that really drew people to her in a way that's almost hard to understand now.
Sure. Well, I mean, Hirschfeld, even during the speakeasies, said that during Prohibition, he said, "I drank during Prohibition because it was patriotic." You know,
it made you feel like you were, you're defying those Puritans just by having a, booze in a teacup. And I think that in a way that, now we just take it for granted. But at the time, this really was a more, maybe Puritan overstates it, but it was a more prim and proper society that they were coming out of. And in fact, if anything, one thing we've learned is Prohibition, the law of unintended consequences, ended up making liquor drinking cool in a way that it never had. And along with liquor, of course, high times, what the wine women in song racket, right, as they used to call it.
Well, what you've done, you've curated our new online exhibition called Call Her Madam, Sex, Crime, and Fun in Polly Adler's New York. And you've brought together these wonderful drawings, really portraits of so many people from Polly's world. I know when I first read the book, which actually Catherine bought for me as a holiday present. Thank you very much, Catherine.
Good job, Catherine.
We were on the phone with Kevin Fitzpatrick, Algonquin scholar, Kevin Fitzpatrick, and this was months before Christmas, and he said, "Oh, there's a new book coming out that really reveals all about the Round Table, and about Polly Adler," and he told us a little bit about it, and we, I was like, "Oh, that sounds like a fascinating book." Then completely forgot about it. And it was Catherine who remembered, wrote it down, and then bought it for me for the holidays. So I'm very grateful. First book I wrote this year and loved it.
Oh, I am very grateful to be included. IFL always loved Al Hirschfeld. This is really the golden age of illustration in general, but he of course is really truly one of the kings of the era. And they really, their worlds completely coincided. As I mean, it was an era, the phrase was cafe society, to kind of describe that mix of entertainers and politicians and Madison Avenue ad men and wealthy playboys, and of course lots of beautiful young women. Polly specialized in hiring young women who wanted to get on the stage, who wanted to break in as dancers or as actresses, and they would. She often had quite respectable young women working for her, just moonlighting. So in fact, many of the great pictures that Al Hirschfeld drew are of backstage sets where you can see that's exactly what she, that was her talent pool there.
Right. Well, that's the first drawing in the exhibition. We're seeing a rehearsal of a review Earl Carroll sketchbook. That's and right. Why don't you tell us how she recruited from there?
Well, you know, probably the most famous name from that era of musical producers on Broadway was Flo Ziegfeld. So the Ziegfeld Follies, those were sort of the pinnacle. And she certainly hired many a Ziegfeld girl who were considered, the tops in beauty and grace. But Earl Carroll, not as well known a figure nowadays, but he was one of Ziegfeld's competitors. And what she often said was it was easier to hire the Earl Carroll girls that were perhaps a slight step down in their talents, often maybe a slight step down in their beauty, but on the other hand, they were more hard up, so they were more likely to take her pitch. It was some of her friends, she had many, many friends throughout the showbiz world and Tin Pan Alley in the music industry and the jazz world. The songwriter Jimmy Van Heusen, who you might know from writing many of Frank Sinatra's great hits right. from the 50s, and 60s, that he describes her going up to women anywhere in like ladies' rooms, at the bathroom, at the bar, at the manicurist, at the hairdresser, and saying, listen, I know, you want to be an actress. Some days it's going to be hard. You may have to pay your rent. You may need to not know where your next meal is coming. Just come talk to old Polly and I can help you out. And it's amazing how many who did. In fact, one of, in this first scene, you see Earl Carroll, who is the producer who often, he also knew Polly quite well. He was known as a scoundrel, if you ask me, among the worst of the producers.
And his shows were sort of dirtier than Ziegfeld.
That's right.
They really featured, we think of Ziegfeld as having these beautiful women and they talk about them being, hardly dressed. But in Earl Carroll's vanities and sketchbook, they literally were not dressed.
Yeah, there is a reason why these were called the Leg and Fanny shows, because that's what people wanted to see. And Earl Carroll would use, it is one of the shocking things I found about when writing the book is we all know about the concept of the casting couch, the idea of trading sex for potential future in showbiz, but it really was not a myth. It was a real actual thing that was a huge part of this world. And Earl Carroll was one of the worst of them. And he would often have big parties, like almost every weekend, where the women who danced in his shows were expected to be there to quote unquote entertain the guests while he dispensed bootleg booze and cocaine, actually. A lot of cocaine, it turns out, in the 1920s as well. Another big surprise.
Everything goes better with coke, evidently.
Yes, Polly herself hated drugs. Drugs, of course, are the scourge of the underworld, scourge of prostitution in general. And she drank plenty and she smoked like a chimney, but she did not approve of drugs and she did not approve of pimps. Those were the two things she hated the most.
Hmm. Well, to get back to the girls, there were some, and you feature some of their drawings in the show. I mean, the names are, it's almost scandalous to say, Dorothy L'Amour.
That was one of my big surprises. Dorothy L'Amour, because Polly was very discreet about things. She would talk about her clients a little bit and her customers somewhat. She wrote a memoir in 1953, in fact, where she talked about some of these. Mostly, though, she was extraordinarily discreet, and that was a big part of her success. But I did get to look at the notes that her ghostwriter had made while they were working on the memoir, House is Not a Home is the name of it. And in the notes, there were a few references because they knew the same people, they were ran in the same crowd. One of them was Dorothy L'Amour, who if many of your listeners may not remember her because she is of an older age, but she was quite famous in the 50s and 40s and the 30s as a singer, and mostly for appearing in the Bing Crosby and Bob Hope Road to Morocco, Road to all the various Road to movies, a huge, huge, big figure. So that was quite a shock, and sweet as can be, a lovely person, known as the Sarong Girl, very pretty. Another one was a lesser known name, but who was quite a celebrity at the time, a woman named Libby Holman, who's also here in the show, who was an early torch singer, as they used to say, and pretty much of a hellion as well. And she worked for her also while she was going to school, like the old saw that working your way through school as a prostitute. It does sometimes happen.
And then we have another one. We have Martha Ray in the show.
Yes, and it's interesting because there are people she mentions knowing Martha. Well, Martha Ray was, they were very close friends. Everyone knew they were friends. When Polly, they made no secret of it. It is not, I don't know for sure that Martha Ray worked for her, but Martha, like many of the people who were scrapping to be in showbiz at this time, show business was not a very respectable business at all. You were not, if you were from a good family with a good education, you did not go into show business. That changes over the course of the jazz age as they start making more money and as their celebrity grows. But so many of the people like Martha Ray. Martha Ray was a vaudeville, born into a vaudeville family, was almost illiterate, never had any formal education, and was basically on her own scrapping for jobs in nightclubs by the age of 14. So that's exactly the kind of person who might well have worked for Polly for a little while before getting on her feet. Another one who is also mentioned is a little bit more of a shock also for me. Again, a lesser known figure, but once a huge star, America's Sweetheart, which is Ruby Keeler, right. From 42nd Street. If you wonderful, beautiful, doe-eyed, young, sweet girl. It's not clear to me whether or not she actually worked for her or simply if they were friends, but even Polly's cousins remember Ruby Keeler and Martha Ray coming out to visit for dinner at Polly's mother's house, saying, oh, what pretty friends Polly has, Pearl has, what pretty friends she brings home.
Now we have a drawing of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, and I want to make clear that we are not making any implication about Lucille Ball.
Yes, Desi Arnaz made no secret about the fact that not only was he one of Polly's more enthusiastic clients, he was also a very good friend when he, she was also a very good friend to him, and they remained friends throughout his life. Frankly, there was not that much secret, even in Desi's lifetime, that he patronized prostitutes. He had a big scandal in the 50s, in the 60s. As for Lucy, it's interesting because I certainly don't have any reason to think that she worked for Polly at any point. However, biographers of Lucille Ball have said, have long speculated that there was a period of time when she was trying to make it, get on stage, trying to get her big break, and was dating some gangsters and going back and forth. And there have always been rumors that she, a number of women, I was gonna say Joan Crawford also was dogged by rumors that she had worked for as prostitutes, same with Barbara Stanwyck. And it just was much more common than we might think. I think maybe we could even liken it nowadays to say, oh, she worked as a stripper while she was trying to put her, you know, get her right. feet, get her on her feet.
Right. Well, and Polly Adler met Desi by going to the club that he was at with her, a sort of a bevy of beauties, right?
That's right. He was the hot new act. He had just only a few years before fled Cuba, and his English wasn't so great, but he was the hot Latin lover figure in the nightclubs. He was famous for introducing the conga as the dance, the music to New York scenes. And he'd made a big splash, and she immediately starts going to his nightclub because it's the hot nightclub with a posse of girls. And he immediately comes over and wants an introduction. She invites him to her house that very night, saying, hey, when you're done with your last, with the last show, why don't you come stop by our house around 2 o'clock in the morning, and nightclub hours. He comes by, he's having a champagne breakfast on the house, and he starts to realize, oh, what this house actually is a house of prostitution. Starts to realize, oh, I can't afford any of this. And she says, well, this one's on the house. This one is, it's all free for you, kiddo. But it was the beginning of a long and lovely relationship. And he describes it in his memoir. He's quite open about it. Like so many of the entertainers were, the other more respectable ones, not so open. But he talks about the fact that for a while, his two biggest fans when he was in the nightclubs were Polly Adler and Brenda Duff Fraser, the known famous as the number one debutante of the year. And he said often you could not tell which were Polly's girls and which were Brenda Fraser's friends, which just goes to show how easy it is to pass.
I'd like to interrupt this podcast interview with a special word from this week's sponsor. This week's sponsor is the Road to Morocco print. You can find this hand-signed limited edition lithograph available in the Al Hirschfeld Foundation shop at alhirschfeldfoundationshop.org. This print was published in 1998 and features Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, and Dorothy L'Amour, who you just heard a few stories about in the interview. For a limited time only, now through the end of September 2022, you can get 10% off of this print by using the code POLLY10 at checkout. That's POLLY10 at checkout. While you're there, maybe you want to pick up some Call Her Madam merch, or maybe you got oil stains on your Jack Lemmon sweatshirt like I did, and you need to order a new Jack Lemmon shirt because fall is going to be here really, really soon, and you want to bundle up. Basically, what I'm saying is, while you're at the shop, just check real quick to see if there's anything else you need, add those items to cart, go to checkout. If you've got that Road to Morocco print in there, use the code POLLY10. That will give you 10% off the Road to Morocco print. That's code POLLY10 on the Road to Morocco print through September 2022.
I think a lot of people will be surprised that Polly has a pretty strong connection to the Algonquin Roundtable.
They were among her very first, after the gangsters, after the bootleggers and the gamblers who really made her name, the Algonquin Roundtable were the people who really first took her up in the legitimate world. And they did not use this phrase, but they were really what we might call the cultural influencers of the day. They were the ones who were writing the columns, writing the criticism. They were always themselves starring in gossip columns for their various adventures, tooling around town quite publicly as sort of the paragon of the party generation. They really were looked upon as, you know, the models of how if you want to live it up in the jazz age, this is how to do it. And so her first customer from the Algonquin Roundtable is George S. Kaufman, the playwright who is still, you still see his plays and his shows.
One of the few playwrights from the 20s and 30s that whose works get revived regularly.
Yeah, exactly. And a very funny man and a really truly great director, but also sex crazed. There's just time. It's hardly unusual. But he was very shy. This was before he became really big, and then at a certain point he got so big he did not need to pay. He could just go hunting starlets on his own. But in the beginning he was married, but they were no longer having sex together. Apparently everyone knew all this. This was very well
documented. They had an open marriage before it was fashionable.
Yes. And everyone seemed to be quite up to date on what was happening in their friend's marriage. It's this one I had no trouble documenting. I never quite figured out how he met her, probably in one of the nightclubs. My guess is the one where Jimmy Durante, the Club Durant, was probably where they met.
Sure.
And he wants to have it be, he doesn't want to go to the brothel. He doesn't want to be seen. He doesn't want to actually have to pay over money each time. So what he does is he gets a charge account with Polly, and he makes a sort of arrangement that what he's going to do is go out to like the street lamp at 72nd Street on the west side in some corner, and he will pick up this woman and they'll pretend like they just met. And he'll take her back to his little pied-a-terre. They have sex, and he drops her off, and back at the street corner. Sure. Sends her on her way. Doesn't pay any money because he can pretend like it's an entirely just a sort of normal pickup, and never necessarily see her again. Later on, this is very important to her. It's the way she gets into this crowd of playwrights and critics and poets and gossip columnists. But it's really only when his good friend Robert Benchley, the humorist, right, really takes her up, and he has no pretense. He's happy to just turn Polly's house into the Algonquin's official late night clubhouse, and he really makes her reputation.
And he's not always patronizing the women. He just likes to hang out there.
Well, that is.
I mean,
his friends like to say, but it's quite clear also that he too, he was quite a womanizer. Right. He too was married. I tell you, I spent a lot of time. I love Robert Benchley. He's my favorite character in the whole book. He is clearly a wonderful man, but he is probably the one who the jazz age was both his era. He was sort of the Pied Piper. In fact, if you look at the picture in the exhibit, Hirschfeld drew Benchley quite a number of times because he was indeed the Pied Piper of the Jazz Age, of this era of wonderful nonsense. He knew every speakeasy bouncer, every bartender, every lady of the evening in town, it seemed like, not to mention more respectable people. But he also was the one who probably, his conscience, I think, is the one it bit him more. And by the end of his life, he had become a fairly broken down alcoholic, and who really was, I think, sorry that his life had gone in that direction. But during his good years, nobody was better.
And Dorothy Parker was a regular visitor.
Yeah, well, that was also something that took me some doing to think about. First of all, in general, was it so common? Because prostitution is not looked on in the same way now, I think, as it was then. Prostitution was just much more a part of the scene. This is before the sexual, or just the dawning of the sexual revolution. It's before there's birth control, before there's divorce. It's quite common for young men to lose their virginity at a brothel. So obviously I had to get my mind around that, but then to have this fact that, and this was not common, that her house became this clubhouse, co-ed clubhouse that people would come to. So you get Dorothy Parker and the other women of the Algonquin Round Table coming, and they treat it, as Polly likes to say, as a speakeasy with a harem handy nearby. And I even still, you know, I could see that it's documented. There are plenty of women, especially as her reputation grows. By the 1930s, she's become kind of the hot after hours clubhouse for the people who go to the Stork Club or El Morocco. And you'd go out to the nightclubs, and when the nightclubs closed, you'd stop by at her house. And plenty of women are coming there. But early on, it was only those daring sort of bohemian Broadway intellectuals. And, you know, how did they think about it? Well, I had to finally, really, I spent a lot of time thinking, what did they think? How did they? And I, you know, there was a great quote from the critic Malcolm Cowley, who said, well, the 20s had their principles, and one of them was to not judge other people, especially if they were artists. So I think it would have been considered square or unfashionable or puritanical to judge whether that was a good plan or not. I think that's how the women like Dorothy Parker thought of it. And in fact, Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley, who were frequent guests, I mean, sometimes as much as every day, twice a day, they helped fill up Polly's bookcases with what they thought she should read: good books, classics, and books by her growing number of friends who were writers.
Incredible. Now, I just want to step back for one second. When you mention Broadway, when we think Broadway today, we think of just really the theater. But at that time, Broadway was a much wider world. Is that not true?
That's right. I mean, Broadway is, of course, a place. It's along that long, beautiful avenue that runs cuts across Manhattan. But it was, it became known as the Great White Way because it was one of the first places to have electrical lighting. And if you're having electrical lighting, that means you can have nightlife. So really, Broadway is more than just the legitimate theater, of which there were many, many, many more theaters. There were, you know, well over 100 theaters just in that sort of Midtown area, because that was the great industry, the greater entertainment, but also vaudeville theaters. Also, that was where the music industry, all the music publishers were clustered, also around Times Square and a little bit south of that. It was where burlesque was all, one of the main couple main burlesque houses were there. So it's not just the legitimate stage, it's all forms of entertainment. And even more than entertainment, it's a sort of attitude. People would often talk about Broadway as a state of mind. They took its morals from gambling. They also had a lot of gambling houses and a lot of gambling opportunities, although that too was illegal. But that idea of a sort of not exactly the underworld, the demimonde, the half world that Broadway, the Broadway state of mind was a little bit on the a little bit of the hustle, a little bit of the con, a little bit of the razzle dazzle. It's where you went. It's not exactly like slumming, but it was definitely only one or two steps above that. And so Broadway as a term, it's really a shame that we don't have it anymore as a term, because it really covered a whole broad array of fun seeking, I guess you might say, fun seeking and profit seeking, the profits from selling fun.
Right. Yeah. But so let's talk about some of the figures that are in the exhibition that were part of that world that weren't part of entertainment or anything. Mm-hmm. They were the gangsters were part and parcel of what Polly was about. We've got two in the show. One is Joe Adonis. He sounds like he would be this, you know, Fabio type character, but is definitely not.
Well, this picture, he's in his older age here, but he was considered quite handsome when he was younger. And in fact, he's the one who named himself Joe Adonis because he thought he was just so handsome. And he was a very close associate of probably some better known names, like Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel and Arnold Rothstein. He was one part of that up-and-coming group of bootleggers who also had their hands in all kinds of illegal activities. But in particular, he really liked nightlife. He liked investing a lot of the gangsters ended up becoming major investors in Broadway nightlife, in speakeasies and nightclubs. And even by the end of the decade, were investing in the show like Ziegfeld's Follies, and they became angels on to the stage because they liked, you know, they're no more immune to the razzle dazzle glamour of showbiz than anyone else. Joe and Joe Adonis, what's interesting is I am sure Hirschfeld knew many, or at least knew by sight, had been introduced, had partied in the same spaces with many of the gangsters. This is the only one of him, only one that I saw that he drew. And the reason why he gets this kind of play as if he's a star is because Adonis, at a certain point after Prohibition ends, tries to clean up his reputation. Even though he's still a gangster, he becomes known as a nightclub owner once nightclubs become legal. And in fact, this image that we have of Joe Adonis is, he was a great patron of Polly's, a very important patron of Polly's, is part of an article that Hirschfeld illustrated for the New York Times, I believe, on the various nightclub owners who had once been outlaws, and when Prohibition is repealed, all of a sudden became figures of, you know, figures of cultural importance. And in fact, it always ticked off Polly that how come those old bootleggers got to all of a sudden be cultural arbiters, and here she is still getting harassed by the cops and taken to to jail.
That drawing was done for a stage magazine, actually. He did drew six different nightclub owners. And he drew, you know, it was Hirschfeld. He wanted to draw from life. But, you know, he would go to the nightclub and start to draw. In one case, one of the nightclub owners, you know, when he saw that Hirschfeld was trying to draw him, tried to run him out of the place because he was so, you know, he didn't want the publicity, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that story. Yeah. That's
great. So, yeah, it got written up in a Broadway column about sort of being run out of, I don't know if it was Sherman Billingsley or yeah, something like that, but
That Sherman Billingsley was a particular foe of Polly's. Did never wanted her in the store club. He ran the store club, and yes, although the store club was filled with call girls, so it was a little bit hypocritical on his part. That is a great story, and that makes a lot of sense. I know the Stage magazine does not have the same cultural cachet as the New Yorker, but if you ask me, the Stage magazine was always one of my favorite sources to look at.
Oh, yeah. It's a great period magazine. It's beautiful too. They had great artwork in it.
Fabulous artwork, fabulous writers, many of them are friends of Polly's, in fact.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And then the other gangster we have in the exhibition is Frank Costello.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, I forgot. That's right. Frank Costello, very important. All from that same era. They were from the same cohort of, they were the modern gangsters, the way that Polly was a modern madam who understood this underworld as a business, you know, as a kind of, they wanted to run it like a profit-making business rather than like a gangs, you know, sort of like ethnic gangs or like poverty, poor people sort of crime. They wanted to be big shot criminals. And Frank Costello probably won that game more than any of the other gangsters of the era. He lived to a ripe old age. Unlike most of them, he served very little time in jail, and he himself rehabilitated himself as a nightclub owner and a respectable businessman. But also as a political kingmaker. He was critical to much of the New York City political establishment, funding them, backing them. And he was also very important to Polly. Besides being a good friend of hers, he helped her out any number of times. At a certain point, she got in trouble for not paying her taxes. And her response was, I didn't know I could be taxed for something like that. Even as she was saying, no, I don't do that. I mean, it was a moment of consternation. It was a big enough tax bill that he had to lend her the money. At that point, he was well known as the owner, the silent owner of the Copacabana, which many people still remember as one of the great nightclubs of the era.
Sure. Sure. Well, I want to ask you about one more drawing, because in some ways it's the only, while we have no drawing of Polly, unfortunately.
I'm so sad.
Yeah, that would have been wonderful. But there is a drawing of an actress playing a character based on Polly.
That's right. Polly, because she became herself a figure, you know, as one of the characters in the book says, it was sort of a snob factor, a slumming snob factor. You would go and you would say, oh, you'll never know who I ran into at Polly Adler last night. And she became kind of this cultural icon of her in her own way, besides the people that she knew. And she was featured or turned into a character in a number of novels and short stories. And in fact, there was a movie made of her life in the 60s. The picture we have here is from a play called A Season in the Sun, which was based on a novel and originally a short story written by Wolcott Gibbs, who was an editor and writer for The New Yorker, and who was also a good pal of Polly's. A lot of the early New Yorker crowd hung out at Polly's quite a bit. And so in this picture, you can see it's got kind of the full cast. And there's the Polly character. She's got a little pile of hair on her top and top of her head, wearing sunglasses. This is based on a real story, a real thing that happened to Polly. They Fire Island, which many people may know of now as a wonderful resort, just only about a couple hours outside of Manhattan. Also a resort for bohemian types and particularly for the gay community even then. So it was a place where still is and was a place with lots of shenanigans of all sorts happening. But to Polly's chagrin, she went out there, had a lot of friends out there, and many friends in the gay community and the showbiz community who all summered out there. And when it is discovered that she's famous Polly Adler, she is essentially run off the island and was deeply embarrassed and humiliated that literally there are people having orgies on the beach and somehow she is not respectable enough. It hurt her feelings terribly. And Wolcott Gibbs happened to be there at the time and he turned it into a story and a play. It was not an unsuccessful play. It wasn't bad. She went to see it. She went to see Guys and Dolls the same week. Also thought they were terrific. It said they should have come to me though for advice. I would have loved to give them a little consulting.
Well, I wonder. You know, it's a shame because Paula Lawrence, who plays her in the play A Season in the Sun, was first of all an old girlfriend of Al Hirschfeld's. He spent most of the 30s. They were in a relationship through most of the 30s. But she was also a very I'm surprised that she was not a patron of Polly's Place. That was her world. You know, she may
indeed have been. I mean, by the 30s, Polly's Place really, by the 30s, the speakeasy era is over with Prohibition, mm-hmm. but there were many people, especially among the well-to-do, who were used to that kind of lifestyle. They liked that kind of nightlife. So they liked going to the big fancy nightclubs where you could show off and there'd be, you'd be in the gossip columns, but they liked Polly's because it brought back that feeling, the feeling of the little taboo hideaway of our own little private club where we can do what we want out of sight. And I would not be at all surprised if Paula Lawrence had been there. Not even a little bit.
It might have informed her portrayal is what I would say.
Oh, I would have loved to have seen it. I would have loved. I don't think there's ever been a film made of it. So I don't know.
No, but it was done often. It was done in summer stock. I know that. And so it had a life outside of its Broadway run, which I find it, fascinating. Yep. And I kind of want to track down the play now. I want to learn more about it.
Yeah, it's the short story. The stories are fun, actually, and it was not Polly's only appearance in the New Yorker. There was a period in the time for a time in the 30s and 40s where Polly Adler and Pollyanna jokes were quite common.
Well, listen, there's almost 30 pieces in this exhibition. It's really, Debbie, you've done a wonderful job in sort of introducing us to this world, to people who love Hirschfeld. I know when I read the book, I kept on saying, oh, this person was drawn by Hirschfeld. Oh, yeah, that, oh, drawn by Hirschfeld, drawn by
Oh,
Hirschfeld.
It was hard. It was super fun task. So I'm thrilled that you asked me to do this. It couldn't have been more fun. And just to get to wade around, I didn't know that you had all this stuff digitized. So it was a pleasure. Just as I hope that this helps contribute a little tiny bit to making that more public, because you guys have such fabulous resources. But it was hard because I could probably have done at least 20 more. I mean, easily, so many more. And I know there are probably some drawings in there that he must have just sketched, you know, back of a napkin, that I would have loved to have seen. I'm sure you don't have everything.
We don't. I mean, those napkin and tablecloth drawings, you know, I'll sometimes go into people's homes and they will have them framed.
I've
heard stories of people, you know, fighting over who got the Hirschfeld tablecloth, you know, drawing on it while they were having dinner.
Well, and that reminds me, I know we should probably wind this up, but I would say one of my very favorite pictures is of the 21 Club here. And that is such a beauty. It's from, am I right that it's from Fortune magazine? Life magazine. And the 21 Club, which the late, now late lamented 21 Club, which was for years perhaps one of the very most famous restaurants and oldest restaurants and bars in New York City, just closed with COVID. It was, Polly was sort of the house madam at 21, the proprietor said, well, if somebody needed a little companionship, they would just slip Polly's number to them, and she bought her liquor from them. But I've never seen an image like this sort of cutaway image that Hirschfeld did. And it's different than Hirschfeld's other stuff too, because it's a full scene. That of all of them, that is probably my favorite.
It's actually his second drawing of the club, because in his book, Manhattan Oasis, he drew it under its original speakeasy name, Jack and Charlie's.
Jack and Charlie's. Well, that was one of my earliest introductions to, I'd seen Hirschfeld's illustrations, of course. They're famous, even for a kid from Clackamas, Oregon, I knew who Hirschfeld was. But when I first started working on this book, at the very beginning, one of the very first books I found was his speakeasies, his Oases of Manhattan. Isn't that the title?
Manhattan Oasis.
Yes, Manhattan Oasis. I asked, I think I told you, I asked the Yale Library to buy it, and they're like, what is this? what is this? And as soon as I told them, they're like, oh no, that's a great book. And so it really terrified. I should get more play, I think. Didn't you reissue it? Yes, is that correct?
It was republished in 2003, right around the time that Hirschfeld passed away. And there's a wonderful introduction that was written for that by Pete Hamill. I'm not sure it's a better version. I love the original version of the book. But if you want to see the pieces and read the text that, although credited to Gordon Kahn, is written by Hirschfeld, and Gordon, who was a good friend of Al's, edited it, and he needed a writing credit before he was going to Hollywood to be a screenwriter. Decided to give him the credit, you know, for that.
Well, I get the sense that Mr. Hirschfeld was a generous man.
He was. He was very much a generous man, and a fun guy to be with. You know, if you were going to go out in the evening, going out with Al Hirschfeld was almost guaranteed to be a good time.
Well, and I think that shows in his drawings. You can just feel the good humor and the affection, even in some of the more, like his picture in the exhibit here of Fiorello LaGuardia, who was a foe of Polly's, not a friend. And he's quite angry. And yet somehow even there, you can catch the humor, almost the affectionate humor in it.
Right. I mean, Hirschfeld, you know, he was not a, he didn't judge people. He observed people, but he didn't judge people. And so he'd like to capture that energy.
And that, I think, was part of the secret of Polly's success as well.
Right.
That this is a world, one of the things I really appreciated, I can't say I approved of all of her choices or all of the things that went on in this world, but I did appreciate the broad-mindedness, the cosmopolitanness, the cosmopolitan attitude in the very best sense of the world that people, that word that that Hirschfeld and Polly and all that crowd really had. She had no time for hypocrites, although the world was, her world was full of them.
Sure. Well, listen, anybody who's listening to this, if you don't haven't already bought Madam, if you haven't gone over to your Amazon link and bought it while this has been, while you've been listening to it, we'll wait here for a moment. You go get your one day delivery and order the book. You will find it fascinating. It's full of stories. You've only heard literally the tip of the iceberg. This Aww. Is a great book full of all kinds of wonderful stories that check all the boxes. You know, you're talking about Broadway, you're talking about sex, you're talking about crime, you're talking about politics, the literary world. It touches on everything. And it's I can't recommend it enough. I'm grateful for you writing it. I'm grateful for Catherine for buying it for me. You everybody listening, you'll do yourself a favor or your friends a favor by buying a copy for yourself and get a second copy so you can give it to a friend.
Well, thank you, David. And let me return the favor. There is some nifty merchandise on the Hirschfeld site. And listen, keep your eye out in the future. Maybe a drawing of Polly will turn up somewhere.
Oh, we hope. We really, really hope. Well, thank you very much, Debbie, for coming on. There's a link to buy the book right on the first page of the exhibition. There's also a link to Debbie's website where you can learn about her other book, which is also really quite wonderful. So do yourself a favor, spend some time in the exhibition. And when you're done with that, spend some time with Debbie Applegate in one of her books. Thanks a lot,
Debbie. Thank you very much.